News Insider from ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
And welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of February 28th, 2017, and episode number 304. And this is your host, as always, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Well, actually, today is March 3rd. And yeah, so we're a little bit behind, but that's okay. We're here. I'm live, but you might not be listening live, more than likely not, because this is kind of an impromptu broadcast. As Tuesday, February 28th, yes, Fat Tuesday, I was ready to go. We were all ready to go, and we had a little bit of a minor emergency at WCJV, so we were not able to broadcast live on Tuesday night, and the network is shut down for about a week or so until we can get everything up and running, I guess. But I wanted to bring you the news. I wanted to get this out to you guys as soon as possible. And I didn't want to wait through the weekend into next week. There's a lot of new news coming up already for next week. Excited about next week's show. And hopefully, everything will be situated. We'll return live, hopefully, Tuesday, March 7th at 7 p.m. Eastern on WCJVRadio.com. And just stay tuned to the Paranormal News Insider Facebook page for any updates on that as they come. And I'm broadcasting live from what I'm calling Site B. Yeah, it's from Jurassic Park. Site B. It's a Mixlr site. I've planned on broadcasting live a while ago, and I had some issues. I don't know what happened. I didn't change anything. All of a sudden, it just started working. But nonetheless, technology, that's the beauty of live radio. Things go wrong. Things happen. And we're here, and we're live. We're okay. We're good. And the radio show must go on. And again, hopefully we'll return live next week. So I apologize to anybody out there that was waiting for the show Tuesday night or Wednesday, but we're here now. So this week's news is brought to you by the International Cryptozoology Museum, located in Portland, Maine. The International Cryptozoology Museum opened in 2003 and contains rare and original items collected by Lauren Coleman, the director of the museum. Visit the International Cryptozoology Museum now at 4 Thompson's Point Road, Suite 106 in downtown Portland. It's there by the water now. It's pretty nice. Haven't gotten out there yet. Hopefully sometime this summer, I'd like to get out there and check it out. Anomalous notes for this week. Yeah, just stay tuned to ParanewsInsider.com. Click on the events listing. I'm updating stuff all the time. I screwed up on a couple of events. I don't know how that happened. Dates were wrong or whatever, and I've got those fixed, and looking forward to some of the events that I'm participating in. Number one, the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure. Yes, you've probably heard me talk about this at least once, maybe twice. It's coming up quickly, May 5th through the 7th, 2017 in Farmington, Pennsylvania. I'll be speaking for the second year in a row. Steve Coles will also be there for year two. Stan Gordon also returning. And new this year, Jay Baitrichin, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and author Ronald L. Murphy, as well as John Sable will be speaking as well on his, not his ghost excavation stuff. He's going to be talking a little cryptid stuff, which is going to be kind of different for him. It's going to be exciting. Don't miss this event. This is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to meet people in the cryptid field. Learn from them as speakers, learn from them through workshops, and then get out in the woods. Yeah, we're going to take you out in the woods and show you how to bang on trees with sticks and how to scream high pitch in the woods. It's a lot of fun. No, I mean, it goes beyond that. We'll show you some tracking techniques and different things that you don't normally see on television or you don't get to hear anywhere else. And a lot of diverse people that are going to be there. There's a lot of giveaways. A lot of big prize packages, stuff going down. And this is the best thing of all, is this is for charities. There's three different charities that this is going to be benefiting. Two of them are animal-based, which is near and dear to me. So I'm looking forward to helping these charities. And the cookout is a good time. Raffles, T-shirts. I mean, this is great. Don't miss out. Again, the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, May 5th through the 7th. You can find more information at pabigfootcampingadventure.com. Don't miss it. And I want to thank Maria Pinero last week, the Media and Public Relations Director for Ghost City Tours, for coming on the show and talking about her event coming up, the Ghost City Tours overnight ghost hunt at the Andrew Jackson Hotel in New Orleans, Louisiana. You get a room with two adults, entry into the ghost hunt for said adults, the use of Ghost City Tours investigation equipment, and the opportunity to take home your digital audio recordings. And from the sounds of it, I mean, it sounded good at that point, but talking to Maria live last week, she really put things in perspective of how this group is a little bit different than your normal everyday ghost tour kind of group that just kind of is there to entertain you. It's a lot of these tours kind of embellish these stories, or they tell the local folklore in an effort to kind of get you into the mood of what's going on. But it sounds to me like Ghost City Tours, they do research. They're based paranormal groups, and they're based on really discovering the reality behind what's going on. So you're going to get a lot of good and accurate information, which is critical to me. And they're not going to jump at every single orb picture and every squeaky shoe as an EVP. So definitely worth it if you're going to be in that area, you want to go on vacation, and you want to experience one of the top ghost city ghost tours, I guess, Ghost City Tours. These events, let's see, April 24th and or Tuesday, April 25th. So you can, it's two nights in a row. So if you want, you can go get two nights at the hotel and two nights investigating. Why not? Sounds like a good deal. I mean, you're going to get back-to-back nights. If you want to, you don't have to. You can do one or the other or both. Again, that's April 24th. And or April 25th, and they're also doing it in October 11th, and or October 12th, 2017. And for more details, more information, they're also investigating a lot of other locations outside of New Orleans, Louisiana. And to see that list and to learn more about Ghost City Tours, go to, well, ghostcitytours.com. It's that simple. And May is a busy month for me. I'll be at the St. Albans Sanatorium event May 19th through the 20th. That's Friday night and Saturday, 2017, in Radford, Virginia. It's called EnigmaCons, and you can find more information at enigmacons.com. That's EnigmaCons.com. EnigmaCons.com. We'll talk more about that as we get a little bit closer. But we're going to jump into the news. I mean, this is the Paranormal News Insider. And our first story this week comes to us from the ghost world. And it comes to us from the website hauntedtheories.com. That's a blog. And this blog expands on a post that was published by noted paranormal investigator and skeptic Haley Stevens. Now, she's been a kind of a pretty popular person here on this show. I've talked about her a number of times, a number of statements, and a number of postings that she's put out there. Usually really good. She gets a little excited about being skeptical, I think, at times, and it kind of bends in her favor, and it's interesting because the story, I think, does the same thing. But, you know, we're all human. We all make mistakes, and we all kind of sway toward our own opinions. It's just normal. It's called human nature, and that's why science has a process, and science has checks and balances for things like this. Instead of just, you know, feeding your opinions, we kind of balance it out. But Stephen's post is from January of 2015 and is titled, "I'm a real-life female Ghostbuster, and I say, bring it on." Well, this post is fueled by the negative response of the rebooted Ghostbusters movie, which features all female leads. Yeah, if you remember, there was a lot of stuff about that. And I don't think anybody cares anymore. I mean, the show's gone. It's not even, I don't even know it's off the DVD yet, but it didn't do all that well, I don't think. But it was a big story last year. A lot of people are really upset about it. I didn't care either way. I didn't even go see it, to be honest. I'm waiting for it to come out on Netflix because I figured it's not going to be really that great of a movie. But I'll eventually watch it. Anyway, Haley states that despite a number of women being involved in the field of the paranormal in very prominent positions, they're not represented equally in the paranormal-related conferences and conventions. Well, as you're well aware, I've created a fairly decent list of conferences, conventions here on my site, which we just talked about at paranewsinsider.com, the home of the Paranormal News Insider. Well, Haunted Theories used this list to see if Haley's statement had any justification. Pretty cool. I'm involved in some scientific stuff here. That's great. It's different, but it's neat. So using this list, the blog on hauntedtheories.com simply says in his blog, "Are paranormal conferences sexist?" to look at Haley Stevens's statement. So taking the ghost conferences list for 2017, it was determined that there were 214 total speakers at all of these events. And of these 214 speakers, 123 were male, or 57%. And 91 of these speakers were female, or 43%. The work on the post also referenced the fact that the ratio of male versus females in the United States is equal, essentially 1-to-1. It's pretty much equal. So if the lists were perfectly balanced, that would mean a 50-50 split on speakers. But obviously with 123 male and 91 female, we see a little bit of off balance. But definitely, I don't think it's completely unjustified or sexist. To be honest, I was a bit surprised by the results when I read this. I mean, I can remember, as somebody who speaks at these events, I remember plenty of conferences where there were no women represented despite their large numbers on teams all over the country. And personally, from my research of paranormal groups over the years, and again, this is just my perspective. This is just my observation. My listing of Ohio of groups in Ohio, I have a website called ohiogroups.com. I've noticed most teams are made up of mostly women. A good majority of the people that contact me about ghost groups are women. And this just goes to show that data doesn't lie. And sometimes our perspective is it's pretty subjective. Now, Haunted Theories also does a breakdown of skeptical conferences and notes something a bit shocking. You know, because Haley makes appearances at these things too, and she's being, you know, a little skeptical even of conventions. Well, with a total of 121 speakers, it was found that 83 of them were male, or a staggering 69%, and only 38 or 31% were female. So the analysis here is that it's doubtful that paranormal conventions or even skeptical conventions are the handiwork of the boys club, but it probably just breaks down to who is available or who wants to speak at these conventions. But like I've said, I mean, I've gone to somewhere there were no females present, or they were kind of lumped in with their husband or one of their groups that they were with, and the women just came up there and spoke. I don't know why. I see that perspective. I see what she's trying to say. It just seems like there's hardly any women that speak. And it is weird because I do think that a majority of ghost groups are primarily women. I think there are more women investigating than men. So it should be more women speaking at these events. But I don't know. Maybe there is a little bit of a kind of an underlining boys club type of thing. And I think men are more analytical and critical of these things, being that of the paranormal and more... expressive as far as, you know, their data and information, and a little bit more aggressive when it comes to their opinions and thoughts on the matter. So, of course, I think that they're going to be speaking a little bit more than women are. Women are more more observers, I think, in this whole thing, and they just want to help people, which I get that. And the man behind Haunted Theories, well, his name is Brandon Masullo, and he's got an extensive background in science and psychology, as well as parapsychology. He studied at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland and had Dr. Carolyn Watt as his dissertation supervisor. So he's been influenced by females in very prominent positions in the paranormal. He's also published an interesting piece of science titled Environmental Sensitivity and Paranormal Experiences, which is definitely worth the read. And it's been cited by a few big names in the paranormal field. So, short, he just knows. He knows what he's saying. He knows what he's talking about. He knows how to take data and put it into explainable information. And I think he's done a pretty good job here. And like I said, I would have expected it to be completely different, but you got to trust the data. And I really appreciate him utilizing my list of events as a resource for his data and referencing it on his blog. But, well, I'll just be truthful here. He's actually a friend of mine, and we've worked together a few years ago in the field, and he's actually a listener of the show, which is why he used this list. So thank you, Brandon. I appreciate what you do, and he's got a lot of stuff in store. So you're going to be hearing his name, and you're going to be hearing Haunted Theories a lot more here on the show as we press forward into the future. And I'm sure we'll hear from Haley Stevens as well. Another ghost story here that we have. Did I say ghost story? I didn't mean it like that ghost story. Just a story in the news, I guess. Well, you don't have to be psychic to know what laws apply to you if you decide to open up a business. Well, Oklahoma City in Oklahoma has an odd law that dates back to 1915, which states that it is illegal to conduct fortune-telling for a fee. Sonia Lisa Marks has been accused of operating Miss Marple's, I guess that's Miss Maple's, psychic reader. That's her business name. That's kind of weird. Illegally, although her attorney feels that she's being unjustly targeted by an outdated and unenforced law. The attorney for Marks, Scott Adams, commented, quote, "They want to turn this into some criminal act, which to me is just a joke. I wish someone could explain to me what is so horrible about someone reporting, reportedly being able to tell you what your future is," unquote. Well, you know, that's, I get that. Okay, you know, maybe there's a little bit of bias towards psychics. People don't like them. They don't trust them. I don't know. But all you have to do is dig a little deeper. I mean, you don't really have to dig very deep. You don't even need a shovel for this one. You can just kind of blow on the dirt, and this is what happens. Well, Marks was charged with theft in Ohio in 1994 and was arrested in 2014 on theft charges from Ohio as well. She was ordered to pay $187,000 in restitution. And you don't have to be a psychic to figure out where this theft occurred or how this theft occurred. You guessed it. I'm sure you guessed it. An undercover police officer went to the location of Miss Maple's psychic reader and paid for a six-minute session for $60. It's kind of expensive. A few days later, an undercover detective paid for a psychic and tarot card reading, but was told by Marks that she would not be happy until she had her aura cleansed, or maybe her wallet cleansed, for an additional $125. Well, there's obviously a giant red flag about a person with a history of similar thefts and cons operating the same scam once again in a different area. Targeted? No. Investigated? Yes. Other psychics, though, have operated in Oklahoma City without issue, which is, I think, kind of an issue. I mean, if you're gonna shut down one, you should really shut them all down. Although these other organizations present themselves as legitimate businesses that provide the service for flat rates and do not upsell like Marks attempted to do, which is a pretty much a con artist favorite scheme for psychic scammers. And if you've listened to the show at all, you've probably heard me talk about this. This happens a lot. It crops up in the paranormal news every once in a while where there's a medium who is pretty much upselling somebody or telling them, well, you can do this, but if you do this for a little bit more money, I can get you here. Oh, well, that didn't work, but this will work here. Just pay me another couple grand. I mean, really, $125 is not that big of a deal as far as some of these stories, but still, over time, the money adds up, and it can drain a lot of people out of money, and that's why Marx is paying this restitution from the Buckeye State. I mean, I'll just say this. I'll insert the generic line here that a lot of people have said. I think even one of the articles I read on this story said the same thing. Well, you thought she would have seen that coming. Okay, well, anyway. Well, what about you? Do you want to open up your own psychic business? Well, if you're in Ireland, you're in luck. See what I did there? No, that's okay. Sean Conway has been seeing spirits since he was just 4 years old. And now, at 45, he's decided that he wants to teach others how to be psychic. I guess it just takes time, right? It takes a long time. Well, the Irish Sun Online reported that Conway said, quote, I'm hoping to set up Sligo's first metaphysical society this year. It's basically going to be meditation and learning new ways of communicating with spirits, unquote. Well, okay. And thus enters one of the most debated aspects about psychics or mediums, that how do they obtain their abilities, and can everyone do it? This is one of the most highly asked questions, other than, if psychics are so good at knowing things, why don't they win the lottery? But I think this one is a little bit much more deeper. Now, if one person has it, does everybody have it? And a lot of psychics will tell you that everybody has the ability. And Conway says, quote, I don't believe this is a gift. Everybody can do it. We're all born with it. I just happen to be open to it, unquote. So in essence, he says that everyone can be psychic and see ghosts and spirits at will. And you know, I've had this conversation with a lot of people over the years, and I used to believe this. I really did. I used to think that everybody has this ability to sense spirits or sense ghosts or see things or have different things happen to them. And myself being put in these situations, I've kind of felt like I've become a little bit more connected to the spiritual side of things. But I'm not sure about that. I think maybe it's a little bit more subjective than that. And I'm open to things. Yes, I'm a little skeptic. I hear what you're saying. I heard that snicker. But at the same time, I try to be open to all things. And I try to embrace the this ability to connect with whatever's out there. But I've not been able to sharpen my skills in 20 years. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe Conway can help me out. I don't know. I think there's some major issues with this line of thinking. I mean, just kind of take a second, and we're going to talk about this, I guess. Now, some people say that it's like a muscle. I've heard this repeated a number of times. I've read it in books. The more you use this, the better it will become. And I've told clients this as well, that they experience a ghost, they see a shadow, and they become used to this, and this connection becomes greater over time because they're able to sense things. And I don't know. It just kind of sounded a little hokey when I said that. So is it like a muscle? You know, you lift the weights or you run down the street a couple hundred times, your legs become stronger. This is the same with your brain. If you continue to do this, does it make it any stronger? I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I've become aware of certain feelings, sensations, and clues within my body. I pay attention to my psychological aspect when I'm at a case, an investigation, to make sure that I'm functioning correctly, mentally and physically, because you know we're kind of EMF detectors or ghost detectors as well. So I want to pay attention to those clues if and when it ever happens. I've had a few instances where some strange things happen, but I mean, does that mean I'm psychic? I'm not sure. I mean, but if I go to the gym and work out like crazy, I'm probably not going to win a bodybuilding contest. Yeah, I'm not going to be Mr. World. And just the same that while almost everybody can run to some certain extent, very few of us would ever be able to compete in the Olympics. I mean, can you play chess at a grandmaster level? Is everybody able to become a member of Mensa? That brainy group of people? No. We all have our physical and mental limitations. It's not because we don't allow ourselves to be at this level. We either lack the genetic makeup or do so just physically or mentally cannot do certain things. It's really, it just breaks down to being human. I really don't think that this would create a new law that, well, there's a lot of psychics, so therefore everybody can be psychic. And just because everybody isn't psychic means that they just haven't used it. And once they use it, it gets better. That just sounds kind of hokey to me. Hokey logic, we'll call it that. But again, if you work out like crazy or you run constantly, even if you push yourself and push yourself hard, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be the best in your field or be able to be at a high level. It's just, unfortunately, it's just not the way it is. Even mentally, like I said, with chess or with learning things or going on Jeopardy or whatever, it's not everybody can compete at the highest level, which is essentially what we're talking about here. Yeah, so I don't know. It's just being human, like I said. I don't think having psychic abilities would be so different than these other things I mentioned. Because I think if it were really that easy, I think there would be a whole lot more people out there claiming abilities, which, I mean, there are already. I mean, how many people have a TV show and go, how many people have a place of business? I'm going to be honest here, maybe a little rude. I don't know. I think a majority of people out there, I would say, probably do not have the ability that they think they have. And some out there are, I mean, let's face it, they're just outright charlatans. And I just, I've talked about these on some of these segments here. Now, in the article, back to the article, he explains his first memory of seeing a dead person at age 4. That's pretty good to have a memory that young. Now, Deirdre Reynolds, the writer that published this article in the Irish Sun, then paraphrases Conway when she says, quote, "It wasn't until his late great-great-grandmother appeared to him 8 years later that he began to embrace his supernatural powers," unquote. Supernatural powers? Well, that doesn't quite sound like something you can learn by breathing and meditating. It's a little bit of confusion there, I think. I don't know. I think she kind of summed it up there as well. That supernatural to me is beyond paranormal. A lot of people use paranormal and supernatural as synonyms, and if you go to some places, they are synonyms. But in my experience, in my research, paranormal essentially is beyond normal. It's beyond explanation, beyond scientific explanation, and you'd have to rewrite some laws of physics or science to allow the paranormal to fit, but it's not impossible. It's just right now we're not in a position to allow these things. And supernatural, this is a little bit more out there. These are things that defy physics and really, really may not ever have a place. We're talking more magical, we're talking mystical, we're talking more religious or biblical type of events. But again, that's just kind of my definition of it, and it depends on where you read things, that things change a little bit. So yeah, now that I've probably irritated a few people, the psychics out there, we're going to move to other news and the big announcement that happened last week. I don't know where you were. I don't know if this will become like one of those things, or where were you when Kennedy was shot, or where were you when the Challenger exploded, or one of those types of questions. I know locally we had an earthquake a long time ago, 1986 or 7, and people talked about that for years, like, wow, where were you when the earthquake hit? I don't know if this is going to be that big, because it's happened a few times already. But I was at work, and the announcement happened at 1 p.m. Eastern. which happens to coincide with usually when I'm going to my my last break of the day, and I kind of worked it out to where I hit the break room right around 1 o'clock and had my phone and went to NASA's channel and put my earphones in and just sitting there watching this announcement live, like the geek that I am, and was taking notes on this big announcement. You might have already forgotten. It's been like a week. Yeah, the headlines. Come on, you forgot already? The planets. Yeah, we might have found planets with water or life. Well, that's what everyone was, you know, blogging about and talking about. And, you know, obviously there was a lot of people that were anticipating the story before it even came out, saying that, oh, they're going to announce that they found life on other planets. Well, you guys say that every single time. And every single time it turns out to be just an announcement of an exoplanet or a bunch. And you guys always jump to conclusions. Well, the big news of the discovery is that they found seven planets of Earth size, and three of them lie in the so-called Goldilocks zone. And if you don't know what that means, it means they're in an area where they're not too close, so they're not too hot, and they're not too far away from the sun or their star, so they're not too cold, and they're just right, not like porridge. Well, I guess like porridge. But it's a planet. And for being not too hot or not too cold, but just being in the right temperate zone, this would be to be able to hold liquid water, which, you know, we consider to be the most likely potential for life to form. I don't think it's completely 100% necessary, but, you know, that's just our mode of thinking. And liquid water would be great. But it would be great to find on a planet. And so it's kind of based on the distance from the sun, their sun. Now, this is where the critical scientist emerged during Wednesday afternoon's announcement. The TRAPPIST-1 system is 39 light years away, or the Star Wars sounding 12 parsecs away, and contains a star that is barely bigger than our Jupiter here in our galaxy. Now, a parsec is a measure of distance, roughly 3.26 light years of distance. Not time, as suggested by Han Solo, but that's a whole different thing we can talk about. Now, this dwarf star means that the planets are actually much closer to their star, their sun, than we are to our sun. We're, you know, here on Earth, we're 93 million miles away. It takes light about 12 minutes to hit us from the sun. There, they're a little bit closer. Actually, they're a lot bit closer. Now, this presents many issues for the perceived formation of water and subsequent life that everyone is focused on. And when I was listening to this, I was kind of waiting for some of the experts to weigh in or talk about this, or I wanted to figure out how they came up with the conclusion that they've seen these seven planets and three are within this zone or whatnot. And I was kind of surprised to see how basic of an observation they made to create these claims. You see these fancy graphics of these planets, and you're on the perspective of the one planet looking up into the galaxy of, or not the galaxy, but you see the solar system there of these other planets hanging in the sky, and it looks all pretty and such, but it's really simple how they figured this out. They just focused on this star, and they waited for it to dim, and how dim it got just basically told them what size of a chunk of rock or something was going in front of it, and they just basically determined that's a planet. And they could kind of figure out the distance of the planet from different aspects of how light or dark the star became. So the observation of shadows created from in front of the star at the TRAPPIST-1 system. It's pretty basic of an observation. They've been doing this for a long, long time. This isn't something new. But this by no means demonstrates that the planets are in a circular rotation around the star. So that being said, and this is my question to NASA, which I don't think they ever answered it. I had to go back to work. I couldn't sit there for the whole entire press conference. But I tweeted that out there. I never got a response. Never saw a response or read through a lot of their notes since then. I've not been able to figure this out. because I don't think they know. Now, their observation of this by no means demonstrates that it's in a circular rotation. Now, if the orbit is too elliptical, it would bring any one of these three planets in the Goldilocks zone too close to the star at any given point in the rotation, or even too far away, and bring them out of the Goldilocks zone that exists around it. So it's more critical that in a smaller system like this, that the planets are a little bit more circular than elliptical. And unfortunately, that's really not how planets work. Most planets are elliptical to some certain extent. They get a little closer on certain rotations around a star than other times. And this can really affect it. Like I said, it magnifies. I mean, we don't go around perfectly, but we don't notice it too much. It's not like the planet here gets like 300 degrees above or below zero. But if we're on a smaller scale, the temperature extremes would be a lot different than what we experience during our seasons. So the second major issue is the development of the star itself. Now, being a cooled star, it would have had a much more turbulent youth than our sun, which, if it was as bright as it could have been, it probably baked these planets and removed any liquid or even in an atmosphere. And doing so would have pretty much killed any life that had developed on it at that point in time completely. But we have to remember that these planets are very close to this main star and only take about a week to orbit it, unlike our 365 and, what is it, 1/4 days or something like that, or like 3 minutes or something. Then, of course, we have the whole distance problem. Yeah, people are all excited. Wow, we're only 39 light years away. That's close. We can just, you know, get on a shuttle and fly there and be back and go on a tour, go on vacation. Yeah, well, 39 light years doesn't sound too far away, but to travel, it's going to take a little bit longer than 39 light years or 39 years. I mean, we're talking the speed of light. The speed of light, 39 light years. Put it in perspective, 39 light years. That's about 235 trillion miles. That's 235 followed by 12 zeros. I don't know what you can walk in a day on your Fitbit. I don't know what you drive cross country in your car, but that's pretty far. 235 trillion miles. Now, Voyager 1, which launched in 1977, is traveling about 10.6 miles per second. Now, that sounds pretty fast. 10.6 miles per second. You'd be going so fast, you wouldn't even register on a piece of equipment if you're driving your car that fast. You'd never get a ticket because no one would ever even see you. But even at that speed, 10.6 miles per second, it would take over 17,500 years for Voyager 1 to travel one light year. Wow. One light year. 17,500 years. And, you know, Voyager 1 isn't the fastest thing that we've ever launched, but it's pretty close. It takes a lot of skill. You got to slingshot around a planet or the sun and, you know, hopefully get it going. And space doesn't work the way you think it does, where you can flick something and it just perpetually goes at this speed, or, you know, it's in no gravity or anything. I mean, there's a lot of gravity out there. There's a lot of empty open space, more open space than anything. But there is gravity, and there are things that will slow a craft down. You can't just push it, and it continues at the speed that it's going. Voyager 1 is actually slowing down. Anything that we've ever launched into space actually slows down over time. And eventually, they'll stop. I mean, you're talking a long, long time. But so 17,500 years for Voyager 1 to travel one light year. So if we do the math, carry the one, blah, blah, add this, zero, okay, this means to travel to TRAPPIST-1, it would take around 700,000 years. give or take a couple hundred. And that's just one way. So that's just getting there. 700,000 years. I mean, my schedule is pretty much wide open in about 30, 40 years. But I don't think I have that kind of time. That's just, wow. I mean, entire civilizations could be gone. I mean, we could be gone in 700,000 years. We think we're going to last forever. No. I mean, the Earth could be gone in 700,000 years. I mean, that's a long time. Granted, I'll be honest with you. I have a pretty large list of people that I would love to volunteer for that journey. Now, despite TRAPPIST-1 being a galactic neighbor, we're just not as evolved as we need to be able to make a journey there worthwhile. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. Wormholes and this and that and all those fancy schmancy things. Those are just theories, or I shouldn't even say theories. Those are like hypotheses. We don't really know if we can do any of these things. We can go through loopholes, or we can throw something into a black hole and pop up somewhere else. If you want to try that, go right ahead. I'll help you build a satellite, but it's probably not going to happen. But you know, we'll keep an eye on this. It's breaking it down. It's still, I mean, it's young. It's sad. I kind of got depressed when I heard the story, because I started thinking about all these numbers and how long it would take to get to these planets, and it just suddenly hit me. And it wouldn't have mattered if I was a 5-year-old kid or in my 40s. Now, it's just startling to think that we'll never reach another planet in my lifetime. It just kind of was like a startling thought that all this work, all this talking about this stuff really is for not for me, the younger generation even. I mean, who knows? It could be centuries before we even get out there to be able to go anywhere near the speed or get anything going out there. I know they're talking about launching these little itty-bitty spacecraft that are a couple inches long with little cameras strapped to them. That would still take a long time. But, you know, it's a vast universe. And who knows? Maybe they'll come to us. Maybe they're already here or coming here or whatever. Maybe they're on their way. Maybe they have Uber in the galaxy. I don't know. But that was a big announcement. I was excited about it. Now, last week, if you listen to the show, I started to talk about a story near the end of the show, and it was kind of one of those last-second things. I just started to kind of look at it, and I got a little frustrated with it, flustered and frustrated. It kind of derailed me as I thought about it. So this story, it has quite a menagerie of paranormal-related items. Call it a paranormal bouquet of confusion. We have a potential Bigfoot, possible ghost, and maybe a psychic dog all wrapped up with a would-be paranormal photograph. Well, let me just start at the beginning. 49-year-old Maxine Caulfield was walking her two dogs, a German Shepherd named Roxy, and Charlie, a miniature Schnauzer. Wow, quite the duo. Well, Maxine was walking her dogs in a wooded area about 7 miles from her home in Northern Ireland, about 40 miles northwest of Belfast. Now, this forest area, Slievenamara Forest, is popularly known as haunted area due to a plane crash in 1942, which killed 8 of the 10 airmen aboard. Now, as she walked her dogs, she suddenly noticed something. Well, Maxine thinks the dogs noticed something, and she feels that they were using what she called their sixth sense. Well, maybe they should open up their own business. She had also brought a camera along and had been taking many pictures. Now, Maxine said, quote, "The dogs are normally full of energy and never stop running, but when we went through that part of the forest, they just stopped still and stared in the same direction. It was as if they knew something was there. I couldn't see anything at the time, but when I got home and showed people the pictures, it was spooky," unquote. While she saw nothing at the time, she did show others her pictures, and many people swear they saw Bigfoot. Well, she also said, quote, "People were pointing out its face and saying it was Bigfoot. I've always been pretty open-minded about the paranormal. I don't disbelieve, and this has really reinforced my view that there could be something out there. The dogs were playing away in the snow, but my German Shepherd's ears pricked up when she went through this section. It wasn't normal. When you zoom in, it really does look like the body of a beast. along with the other history and rumors about this place that really makes you think, unquote. Well, let me pause right here for a moment. I usually tell these stories as they're interpreted by the witness or the person writing it before breaking these stories down. But this story, this needs a quick break check. So your dogs take a rest, you take some pictures and show people. They point out a weird figure, and this reinforces the possibility of it being Bigfoot because a plane crashed nearby. That is confusing. Well, Maxine said, quote, I honestly didn't realize what was there at the time. I take a lot of pictures when I'm out with the dogs, and this time I'm glad I did. I couldn't see what the dogs were looking at. I kept thinking, is somebody coming? Am I safe out here on my own? I put it out of my mind, really, and didn't think any more of it, but it was only when I sat down and had a proper look at it that I thought it was a bit freaky. It all adds up to some odd things going on. I've never seen a shape like that one in the picture, unquote. So she's freaked out, by her dog's behavior. Because there's an odd shape, she's convinced that something sinister was afoot. Now, as far as the picture, it doesn't look anything sinister to me. It looks like an uprooted tree to me. And yes, dogs are curious, but they also have senses that are much better than ours. Not that dogs are psychic or they have sixth sense, but they have a better sense of smell. Their sight really not all that better. I think if a Bigfoot was lurking nearby, a German Shepherd would certainly let their owner know a little bit more than just kind of yipping, or not even yipping. She said it was just standing there staring. So she got a little bit nervous, which led to this photograph. So I think it's just a runaway imagination, if I had to say anything about it. Well, yeah, Mardi Gras has come and gone, but it wouldn't have been Mardi Gras without talking about bread and beer. You know, bread. I didn't really get to talk about it. I don't have any left. I ate them all. Those paunch key things. I know people say Patsky or Ponchkies or Putskies or Petuskies. I don't know what you call it. Ponchki. I ate all mine. Anyway, so that's the bread. And beer, come on. I mean, it's Mardi Gras, for crying out loud. The Asahi Brewery Company out of Tokyo, Japan, had a very simple idea for a television commercial. Now, personally, I think the idea came about 15 minutes before work let out, and somebody raised their hand and said, hey, I got an idea. Let's put our logo in a field of crops. Yeah, that's pretty much probably how it happened. Well, the production company, Dynamite Productions, scouted areas in southern Australia and found the perfect spot in Hatherley, South Australia. What seemed like a simple idea then involved a surveying company, Cameron Locke Surveying, and they took on the task of converting the beer logo into a crop to create, not really a crop circle, but a crop logo, I guess. And the logo was to be real. As the Asahi Brewery stated, there would be no digital effects used in the creation of this commercial. And this was a major scale. The logo was to be 200 meters wide. And that's 656 feet to you and I here in the United States. Or just over 2 football field lengths wide. That is enormous. And it's by 350 meters high. I guess, you know, in the direction of the camera facing it. Which is 1,148 feet or 382 yards, just shy of 4 football fields. That is huge. Now, Mike Cameron of Cameron Lock Surveying said, quote, it was a matter of us mapping the paddock they wanted, scaling up and getting the orientation right, and literally tracing it on foot in the paddock, unquote. The interesting thing here is that they used a company called Mazescape that took the logo, put in the dimensions of every letter and use the scale of the creation of this whole thing. Mind-boggling process here. And what it did, it basically spit out GPS coordinates for every every part of the logo. I mean, that's just amazing. They used 48 cans of spray paint to map out the letters, where they're going to be, including Japanese symbols, and then used a variety of methods to flatten the crop. They used tractors for the larger area surrounding the logo, drum rollers, and even brush cutters. But one method they used is very symbolic to crop circles, the good old rope and plank. Now, this was a method that Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley, collectively known as Doug and Dave, used when they fooled the world for many years until coming clean in 1991. Now, another difficult thing with the project was walking in and out of the circle, which created a bit of a chore. There was only one way in and one way out when it came to a string of letters, which then created a maze for those within the letters to get out without damaging the overall design. Amazingly, the crew of 40 worked from dusk to dawn for a week to finish the product and filmed it with drones before it was ultimately harvested and erased forever. Sad. Well, this effort took an estimated 3,000 plus man hours to create, which was for a 15-second advertisement. Wow, that's a lot. Well, was it worth it? Well, for those involved, actually, it sounded like it was very enjoyable, even though the crop was destroyed and it was only for 15 seconds. They wished it would have lasted a little longer than that. Now, Asahi might not be a household name, but the company was formed in 1889 and was formerly known as the Osaka Beer Company. Asahi owns a 38% market share in Japan as the largest beer seller in the country. Now, the United States, that honor goes to Anheuser-Busch, which owns a 45% market share. Now, this is a book. I have a book of the week here. And all of these links, all these stories I've talked about, don't really have an audience live here because I made an announcement that I was going to be on like an hour before it actually went on. So things got a little screwed up here. And so, unfortunately, I don't think there's any live listeners there. I don't see anybody in the chat room. So I couldn't really share any links to any of these stories. And I will during the week. So you're going to see this giant beer company logo. I'll send you all the links. I know it's a short period of time between now and Tuesday. So I'm going to have to double up on some of these things. But I'll send you out some of these links to these stories so you can take part in them as well. So you can see what I'm talking about. It's one thing to listen to this. And I'm sure you've seen some of these stories. But I mean, why not? So this book of the week, this week kind of piggybacks on the whole, crop circle phenomena. And I've wanted to use this book, before. It's the book of books when it comes to crop circles. And I mentioned Doug and Dave. Now they fooled the world, for a long time and they came clean in 1991. Well, this book that I'm holding in my hands here from Fane's Press is written by Pat Delgado and Colin Andrews, two of the premier, I guess you call them experts in seriologists, the people that study crop circles. And the book is called Circular Evidence, a detailed investigation of flattened swirled crops phenomena. And this book was published in 1989. And it really chronicles how crop circle research and investigations started in the early 1980s, and it's kind of a trip with Pat Delgado and Colin Andrews, who both of these guys were, like I said, the premier researchers of their time in Great Britain. And, you know, their work really started really heavy involvement. And this book was one of the first books, actually, I think it was the first book on crop circles, Circular Evidence, a Detailed Investigation of the Flattened Swirled Crops Phenomena. It's the compelling first-hand account by England's leading investigators of the crop circle enigma. And crop circles were huge in the 1980s. It was the biggest paranormal phenomena going at that point in time. So, you know, what we know now, crop circles are kind of a joke. But this book was, again, published 1989, 2 years before the announcement by Doug and Dave that they had, in fact, been creating fake crop circles for years. And unfortunately, When you read their work, you find out that a lot of the crop circles that are featured in this book were their handiwork and their work. At least they say they were. Now, I've talked about the Doug and Dave story in the past where they created a circle unbeknownst to any researchers. They had contacted the media. The media watched them create a circle from start to finish. And they brought in Pat Delgado, who is one of the authors of this book. And Delgado researched the circle and stated matter-of-factly that that circle was not a creation by human hands, and that it was, in fact, a genuine crop circle. Well, that didn't bode well for him, and nor his career. And he actually left crop circle field, the seriology field, I guess you'd call it, shortly after. But he also had some health issues and sadly passed away a number of years ago. But if you check this book out, it's really interesting because when you say crop circles, you're probably thinking of all these intricate designs, these geometric patterns, these amazing pictures within flattened crops. But in reality, in the 1980s, these were just crop circles. They were just circles. There were some designs, as a matter of fact, in one of these chapters they show how the crops were typically flattened and the typical shapes that were seen and the typical placement of circles within circles or next to circles or patterns of grouping of circles. And there was only a certain amount that they were pretty much encountered out there in, I guess you call it, in the wild. So this book is really, really interesting. On the, I would say, early history. And, you know, you could say, well, what about that woodcut from the 1600s? Oh, the mowing devil. Well, they don't talk about the mowing devil in this book. What they talk about in Circular Evidence is what they had in front of them, is the information and the data that was in front of them. And unfortunately, yeah, unfortunately, they kind of talk about it as, they didn't really say that it's aliens per se, but they do talk about that a lot of people believe that it's aliens. But they also mentioned some other popular theories that were floating around at the time, from electrostatic things from the Earth's magnetic field and wind shear and wind patterns and different things that potentially could have happened. But yeah, I mean, there was, and obviously too, they also talked about the fact that some of these were probably more than likely man-made, but unfortunately, they kind of went in the direction with a lot of these and said that they were definitely not man-made. And they did spend a little bit of time kind of talking about the difference between what is man-made and what is not man-made. But unfortunately, history would kind of tear their theories apart a little bit when Doug and Dave came out and said, well, yeah, we faked that circle, by the way, the one that you said it was genuine. But again, it is a good book. If you're into crop circles, you have kind of a curiosity about it. This book is cheap. It's very cheap right now. I spent a few bucks on mine, but you can get it for like a penny on Amazon. Again, Pat Delgado and Colin Andrews' book, Circular Evidence, A Detailed Investigation of the Flattened Swirled Crops Phenomena. This is a book I've been holding out on for a while. It's the premier book on crop circles. Check it out. And I'll get that link out to you sometime during the week. And that's it. That's all she wrote. I'm up against the time limit here because Mixler gives me an hour. So I only have an hour. But again, hopefully we're going to return live radio, WCJVradio.com, WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern. I hope to have it for you there. So as always, keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.